Hi, everyone. This is Michael Cox for the Incommon Podcast. This is the fourth episode in the Future Fisheries Management series of the podcast. In this episode, I speak with Andrew Johnson, the CEO of Marfish Echo, a consultant-based organization that provides advice and support for the future of sustainable, profitable fisheries. Andrew founded Marfish Echo based on his experience with short-term environmental consultancies that, in his terms, he felt were delivered quickly but often without the rigor of academic research. During the interview, we discuss Andrew's experiences moving into and out of academia and his lessons that he has drawn from founding and running a consulting organization that brings theoretical and applied expertise to conservation challenges. And like each of the guests in this podcast series, we talked about the World Trade Organization's role in fisheries policy through its recent agreements to limit the role of subsidies in this sector. This conversation is a bit dated now since we last talked in that regard, as the WTO has had a subsequent meeting on subsidies that is not reflected in our conversation. If you're interested in learning more about that topic, I have included some relevant links in the show notes for this episode. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Andrew Johnson. Can we just jump right in, Andrew, with what I now call the origin story question? I guess I don't even need to say that I now call it that because I've been calling it for like years. But just to give the listeners a sense of who you are professionally and where you're coming from, could you talk to me about what initially interested you going back as far as you want, years, decades? What initially interested you in fisheries science and governance, and kind of how do you make sense of your career arc thus far leading to the PhD and subsequently as well?
Sure. So I was brought up by the coast. So I was always kind of around fishing and fishing communities. And at school, I was actually terrible at biology and I was quite good at physics, but I decided that I wanted to have a career outside because I always used to love going fishing and things like that. So I opted for biology and I studied marine biology at university. And as part of my course, I was lucky to do a course at Plymouth University in the UK, and they have a commercial diving certificate as well. So I became a commercial diver and I worked with the BBC and doing lots of different surveys and things like that. So I was kind of out in the field all the time and got more and more interested in life underwater, I guess. And that's what took me towards doing the PhD, which was a PhD focused on fish ecology. So why fish are there, basically, why are they living in certain habitats, and what does it mean for marine protection? But then as I kind of matured away from that, I think I realized that actually we can't really manage the fish in the water. We manage the people that exploit them. So my interest slowly graduated towards the fishing industry themselves. And since my PhD, really, my main interest has actually been on the activity of people and how they interact with the sea. And definitely, as I've grown older, I enjoy the interaction with fishing communities and with policymakers, etc. Even though it can be quite conflictory at sometimes, I find that as part of the challenge of the job, and that's where I am today, really. So I'm an opportunity hunter that enjoys speaking to the fishing industry, I would say.
And Andrew, I have it that you got your PhD in fisheries ecology in 2012 from Bangor University. Could you talk to me a bit, though, because it's kind of almost a trope on this podcast that we'll often talk to ecologists who kind of have this realization that you had that governance, you know, environmental management is people management, et cetera. How did you kind of onboard yourself professionally as someone who's thinking about human behavior?
Oof, yeah, I left the PhD being somebody who's an expert in, as I say, fish ecology. So understanding where fish live and why, and kind of, you know, thinking about stock assessments and habitat requirements and marine protected areas and spatial designs and things like this. But I actually, when I finished my PhD, I'll be honest with you, I was very tired of academia and I took some time out, and I was lucky enough to be awarded a Winston Churchill Memorial Trust grant, which took me to South America. And I went there to work on the TURFs that they have out there, territorial use rights in fisheries. And that was my kind of first introduction to really switching sides, so to speak to the fishing industry and find out why they were doing what they were doing because of this success story they had over there in Chile. And, but I would still say, even, you know, I'm almost 40. So, you know, this is kind of a long time ago now, my PhD, 12, 15 years or something. I would still say that I have so much to learn about the human dimension of fishing, definitely. I don't have a dislike for the fish ecology side of things. I just find that, I was sat there in models and spreadsheets and stuff, whereas, that for me, I really enjoy the interaction with people because it can be very diverse, but very quickly you can start to understand patterns. So, yeah.
What about academia were you tired of or struggling with? Because I think a lot of us who stayed in academia, we really enjoy it, but there's always something that's challenging.
Yeah, I think well, it's funny because my career, if you actually kind of draw the timeline out of my career, it's punctuated by holes where I've completely left academia. And every single time that's happened, people have kind of grown slightly and said, oh, that's career suicide. You need to be careful with that. But for example, when I finished my bachelor's, I didn't even think I was going to come back to marine biology. I was actually tempted to go and study medicine. But I went away traveling, and then suddenly these opportunities to, go diving somewhere to do some work for somebody else's PhD came up. And then when I finished my PhD, I was really fatigued by just this whole drive to publish peer review all the time. And to the point where it kind of came to the detriment of my actual interest in it, because you're kind of pushed to make sure you have high impact paper. So therefore you have to tell the story in this way. And oftentimes some of the things I was interested in were not going to give me enough of that currency. So I was kind of just thought, oh, this is just a big game, and I don't want to keep publishing. But, like everything, you have a bit of time off and you come back and you realize you're still very interested in it, et cetera. And then I was lucky enough to land, after 2 years away from my PhD, I landed at Scripps in San Diego, which is a very nice place to work because of the location and lots of science, and there's good funding opportunities there as well. So, I dug back in, and that's where I am now, really. But I have just to finish the last part of the story, I left Scripps, took another 2 years out, and then I was offered an assistant professorship at Edinburgh at Heriot-Watt University, and I was there for 3 years. And then again, I left Heriot-Watt in September last year, so I'm now a non-academic. So maybe I shouldn't even be speaking to you. Am I allowed here?
Well, yes, you're more than allowed. Part of what you're talking about is kind of almost universal phenomenon where I feel like a lot of, particularly in professional settings, they become gamified. So it's less about the kind of intrinsic motivations that maybe brought you to it, and it's more about everything kind of becomes instrumental. So it's like I'm doing the science because, and in a way, this is a concern, right? I'm doing science now because, and in a way that leads to a particular output rather than doing science or whatever you're doing for its own sake. And that can be deeply demotivating for many people.
Exactly. It kind of felt as though kind of the magic was gone, where you can't just sit there and ruminate on an idea and start to ask questions. You need to make sure that your ideas are pointed towards certain funding opportunities or certain things that might work particularly well because there's going to be more money coming the next year, and this sort of thing. And the other side of academia I do find difficult is, I mean, universities now have turned into it's a business, and the most popular courses win, so you're kind of forced to teach maybe away from what you would really like to be teaching or potentially what you're hired for. And instead you're asked to teach things that, a university knows is going to bring money in because they're a popular course, et cetera. So yeah, I think it's difficult. Speaking to much older professors, emeritus guys and people that have been out of academia, but because of their retirement, they had the glory days where you could sit there and really be creative with science, I think. Whereas now I think there is a, like you say, it's become a bit biased and maybe a bit gamified. But that's not to put it down entirely, but I just, for me, I've always been lucky enough that I've always had another option. And I think that was just based on good advice from one of my PhD supervisors, Hilmar Hinz, who just said to me, even if you take breaks, just try and keep your publishing going, which I always have done.
Yeah, it's not bad advice if you can afford to kind of have parallel tracks in your work. I've also just found that helpful sometimes. So I have like the podcasting track, and that's often a break from doing something else. And some days when I don't feel like doing the podcasting, I'll go on to the one of those other things.
I mean, it can be quite amazing. I mean, even if you, for me, even if you've just got something like I don't know, you go to a local school and you give a presentation to school children. I mean, that can inspire enough energy in me to keep me going for 6 months sometimes, where you've had a really tough time with work or whatever, but you go and you tell people why you love something. And even this conversation, I'm sure after this, I'm going to sit down at the desk and feel quite motivated because I kind of remind myself of how I've got here and why I'm still here,
Yes, one previous guest a couple of years ago joked that it felt like being interviewed with us was kind of like professional therapy, and that was kind of to me the highest compliment that I've been paid as an interviewer.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. Yeah.
Andrew, you also mentioned your work in South America. Was that in Chile?
Yes. Yeah, that was. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned the TERFs, territorial user rights fisheries, and that's just a particular area of interest of mine. So I'd love to ask you at least one follow-up there. You mentioned that these are understood as a success. Could you give the listener a sense of what these are like and what your experience was like working on them?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not an expert in TERFs by any means. And my only real experience with TERFs themselves is in Chile. I mean, in Africa, you have things like beach management units, which could be slightly synonymous. But ultimately, whilst I was finishing my PhD, I was reading a lot of work by Juan Carlos Castilla and Stefan Gelsic. And actually, Stefan had been at the same institute that I did my PhD, but unfortunately, we never crossed paths because he was there before me. But you know, I read about this idea that maybe we should look backwards instead of looking forward. So we're always thinking about these really crazy complex modeling approaches to predict future stocks and look at human behavior and the dynamics between the two. Whereas, you know, if we look backwards and think how were things managed before, maybe we could learn lessons from the past. And I wrote a couple of very simple blog articles, which were probably full of inaccuracies. But the idea is ultimately that you give the ownership back to the fishing community, and then it's, you know, a self-organized system. So they will say, well, okay, this is my turf, this is my area that I will manage, and I will be the steward of this area, and then my neighbor will have the area up the road, and that will be their kind of area to manage, etc. And obviously, this is all based on the fact that you need a species that it works with. I mean, if you have a highly migratory species that moves through, you know, 25 different areas within a year, it's not going to work very well because all it takes is one neighbor to overexploit, and then there's nothing left for the neighbors down the chain. But in Chile, the famous story is with the abalone fisheries. And basically, yeah, I was awarded some money by this charity in the UK, and I went out there and I met with Stefan Gelsic and some of his team, and just traveled down the coast by myself and was interviewing fishermen there. And it was really interesting. And I think there's a lot to be said for that approach, but it has to be in the right context, you know, because it won't work with highly migratory or mobile species, etc. Having said that, whilst I was there, I went quite naively thinking, oh, this is, you know, all perfect, everything works really well. But whilst I was there, you know, there was a bit of a conflict happening between two neighboring turfs, and there was a shooting even, you know. So these things, they look good on paper, but you know, people were still poaching in the night times from their neighbors' areas and things. So yeah, they need to be very context specific, I think.
There's kind of an irony that's been written a lot about in the pro community-based governance field, both in conservation development, that in arguing for decentralization participation, those themselves can become kind of cannibalized by the implementation process. And we start to lose sight of like the idea that there's actually many different types of community. There's not like one model of community and community governance necessarily. And I feel like that's one of the more important lessons learned in this space is it's even if you start to like a model and it's got the right keywords for you, you never get away from this danger of kind of over bureaucratizing and formalizing at the expense of understanding what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So Andrew, could we move to and you're gonna maybe have to tell me or correct me how to pronounce this organization. I'll say what my brain comes up with, which is Marfish Echo.
Fine.
Okay.
Yep. Or Marfa
Okay.
Chico. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it depends if you're American or English, but that's both are correct.
Okay. So you would say Marfish Echo?
That's what we say. But I mean, the idea of the name was basically it's marine fisheries ecology or economy. That's why we did it, because we were doing both ecological work and economic work at the time. So, but
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I'm not fussy.
Okay. So this is really interesting to me, in part because as an academic for, well, a while now, I've sometimes missed feeling more like an entrepreneur, like I'm really creating and, well, creating organization in this case. So I'd love to hear about your mindset going into this. What motivated you to really co-found or found an organization, and was it nerve-wracking? Did you kind of go through all the things that one might imagine in starting a new project like this that's really going to be a large part of who you are moving forward potentially? Could you take me back to your mindset when this was kind of being birthed in your brain?
Sure. Yeah, I think just to preface the actual formation of the company, as I said before, I've kind of taken little stints in and out of academia. And even whilst I've been an academic, I've done, side projects for consultancies, etc. So I've tried a bit of consulting before. And ultimately, whilst I was coming to the end of my postdoc, I was starting to kind of get a few emails from people saying, oh, would you contribute to this consultancy, etc. And I did a bit of work here and there, but one thing I always kind of thought was that consultancy was incredibly rushed and you could never really get to the same type of depth as academic work. And it makes sense. And there's a lot of good reason for that. But I mean, arrogantly, I probably just thought, well, I think I can do the consulting side of things with an academic bent, so I can go deeper and provide a consultancy client with more kind of return for their money, basically. So yeah, I left Scripps Oceanography and I was lucky enough to win a contract with World Fish, where I went to the Solomon Islands and I was there for 3 months working with some guys out there. And by the time I got home, I just suddenly started getting lots of emails from people saying, oh, we've got a bit of consulting here and there. And I, was diving in and out of it. And very quickly, I mean, luck just seems to be on my side often. And suddenly I had too much work for me. And there were two choices: either I turn it down, or I, try and recruit somebody and say, "Hey, can you help us do this?" And that's really where the business started. And since then, we've just kind of grown the team. And not everybody's full time by any means. I mean, people are kind of like me; they have the same. They don't mind the risk of not knowing what work is coming, but they'll dip in and out and things. So, yeah. Now we have a really good team, and actually, it's starting to come full circle now that we're large enough. This year, I've actually just sorry, last year now, 2023. We've just started funding our first PhD student through the consultancy. So,
Wow, very cool.
we're still quite academically linked. So we've got a lot of university partners and things, and we have some more academic money coming in as well. So it's quite interesting, yeah.
And Andrew, could you tell me a bit more about the nature of the work? Is it quite diverse? Do you feel like you've developed quite a niche for yourself? How has that played out?
I would say we don't really have a niche in terms of our subject matter, but I would say we have a niche in terms of our objectivity. I mean, a lot of our clients come back to us because they know we're not just going to kind of give them something polished to make them happy. I mean, quite often I'll upset our clients by giving them something that they might not like, but my job is to be objective and report facts and numbers, which is what I do. Which is sometimes a little bit difficult in the NGO space, because we'll deliver a project. And then the NGO will be like, oh, but this isn't the way we want our agenda to look. And I'm like, well, these are the facts, and then sometimes where there's a bit of a disagreement and we will leave them with the work we do, but then we might take our name off the project if it gets turned into an agenda piece too much. But so we don't really have a niche in terms of subject matter, but the portfolio of work's incredible. I mean, it's really that's one reason I really like consulting is because we have such a diverse range of projects. And because I've been lucky enough to build quite a large team now. I get to suck in the knowledge of experts from all over the place, people that work in, blue finance, blue economy, and then we have people that are markets experts, etc. So for me, it's still almost like I'm a student, really. I'm just kind of managing the projects and learning as I go.
I mean, that's interesting you say that, right? Because I think in academia, that's seen as one of the main benefits of that job as well, is that you can be a lifelong learner, right? I think that's what a
Yeah.
lot of us are pursuing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why generally, I mean, I don't really think we've ever had a consulting project that I haven't been excited about to take on. I mean, then the other luxury is, we've generally had enough work that if we really don't like the look of something, then we won't take it on. I mean, we have had a few requests for things that I would consider to be a little bit dodgy. So we've just kind of said, not for now, thank you very much. Because we do want to work on projects that promote sustainability rather than exploitation. And obviously you've got these two traditional, you've got the conservation mindset, but then you've also got the extractive. We kind of sit in the middle trying to help the extractive be more conservation minded, but then also help the conservation side of things understand why the extraction happens as it does and where the kind of comfortable middle ground between those two things is.
That's really interesting. What do you think about you and your team's skill set helps you do that effectively? Because I feel like that's not about being able to crunch numbers per se, right? If it's a part of how you're engaging with people. How do you cultivate those kinds of skills?
Yeah, I think it's yeah, you're right. It's a lot of it's about the interpretation. I think I always just remind our team that our job is not to give our opinions primarily, it's to give the facts. And then if we're really pushed, so for example, if we're doing an investment project where a company wants to buy another fishing company, let's say, and they say, is it sustainable? Are we going to make money in 10 or 15 years' time? We'll give them the facts. And then very often the client hasn't got enough, and they'll kind of say, well, tell us what you think. What would you do if it was your money? You know, and I always try and sit on the fence as long as possible because it's not my decision. But I think really, before any of those conversations happen, you've just really got to understand the context in which something is happening, and also understand the motivation of the client as well. Because if you don't understand their motivation, you can't really ever advise them, even if you do want to give them your opinion, because you don't know the reasons that they are potentially trying to buy the company, for example, or whatever they are trying to do. So, but like I say, it's not always plain sailing. Quite often with the NGO community, we'll run successful projects, but then they'll say to us, oh, well, this doesn't really align with what we want. So can't we just say this? And we'll have to kind of say, well, no, you can't. If you're going to be objective, no, you can't. That isn't actually true. And then, you know, there's a lot of back and forth towards the end of a project. And sometimes everybody aligns, and other times the NGO will choose a different message. But I mean, that's fine because it creates conversation, and that's half the reason that we have jobs in this field.
I think there's this, well, I know there is in my field a movement towards both interdisciplinarity and now transdisciplinarity. I've sometimes worried that I think those are kinds of concepts that are more fun to write about than to really try to implement. They're like pretty hard to actually, and a lot of it's about bridging across different groups, trying to be less dismissive. And so transdisciplinary, right? Like actually doing action-oriented research that's co-developed with some extra academic partner. Well, and it's often assumed that in this process, the goals of the extra academic partner are kind of sacred, right? It's like, well, let's not just do science, but let's think about like local organizations and communities. What do they want? And it's framed as being like that those are kind of beyond question. And I think that it's good that we're moving in this direction to kind of co-develop science, and not just kind of, this isn't in response to parachute or extractive research, right? Like I go in, I collect my data, and I don't worry about how this is benefiting the people I'm working with. So we're moving far away from that, but now it's not always smooth sailing, as you said, that the other people do have their own goals and motivations, and those aren't uncomplicated, I guess, is reflecting on what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's in some ways I treat it as a very easy position that we need to take, which is, you know, I force the team to try and sit on the fence, provide objective information and data and facts, and we try and stay there as long as possible until we're pushed into this corner to give an opinion, you know, that may not be based on the data that we're looking at. But I think the difficulty in doing that is just to remember what is objective and what isn't, you know, because when for example, if you're in a multi-stakeholder workshop, and you know, there's a lot of I don't want to say insults flying, but there's a lot of conversation, it's getting a little bit heated, and you're the one that's presented something that has driven that heated conversation. You've got to kind of calm the masses that are, you know, very divided, but then bring people back to the facts, and then, you know, start again. But I think over time you just kind of learn to be personable. And most people I find are actually fairly aligned. You know, like we assume that conservation NGOs are totally anti-fishing and vice versa. But, you know, I've never met a fisherman or fisherwoman in my life that has ever wanted to overexploit a stock. You know, it just doesn't, you know, so everybody wants conservation of nature, but one, because they want to make money from it or livelihoods or eat, and the other one because they want it for the natural capital that's there in the water anyway. So I think people are aligned, but there's just this tradition of conflict that we kind of rest on, assuming that it's going to happen, but it doesn't need to often, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've often thought that some of the most heated arguments are between people who agree about 90% of everything, but then it's like
Absolutely.
you really focus in on that 10%. It's if you tell someone, hey, I agree with you about 90% of the stuff, they're often going to focus their question is not going to be, let's talk about the 90s. Like, well, why do you disagree with me about the 10? And I think all our brains do that a little bit.
Maybe that's a human disposition thing. I'm not sure, but that's entirely right. You should get that tattooed somewhere.
Yeah, right. Andrew, you've been traveling around a fair amount recently. Is this still quite very fieldwork based? Are you traveling around a lot to go to particular places and collect data there? I'm just curious again about the nature of the work, in part again, because some of our listeners are, you know, in PhD programs, they're thinking about future careers, et cetera. I'm trying to help paint a picture of the nature of this type of work for a variety of folks.
Yeah, so it's a bit strange because obviously we had the brief COVID interlude, which kind of grounded all of us and kept us all at the desk. But I would say probably within a year, we normally have maybe 30 to 50% of our work is outside of the office, depending. So that could be outside locally in the UK, which might just be, you know, running some different fishing gear trials or working with industry and workshops, etc. Or it might be much, much more grandiose trips. For example, headed off to, we were in Micronesia last year for almost 3 months, myself and a colleague, Lois, and we stayed out there, actually two separate trips. So we do get a lot of travel. Some of that travel is involved with the more traditional collecting data, you know, visiting communities, looking at fish catches, writing down numbers. But then also a lot of it is involved with kind of running stakeholder workshops to make sure we get a mixed and diverse range of opinion to take back and then to try and interpret whilst we're back here. And often that's why the larger projects have two trips, because you'll go out, collect the data, bring it back home, sit and have a headache with it for a number of months, and then go back to your communities or your agencies and then present to them and try and come up with a final technical document or whatever it is you're working towards. Yeah, so lucky we do get to travel quite a lot. Yeah.
So Andrew, you've mentioned your work on fishing gear. I'd be curious, and so you can take this in one of either direction here. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to hear more about your work on evaluations of fishing gear, economic, ecological, because I know you've worked on that. If you'd rather take this in the direction of international fish trade policy, which is something else that we wanted to talk about, which one of those two topics are you kind of more interested in chatting about now?
I think the easier one to talk about is probably the fishing gear stuff, because it's a bit more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, but, let's do it.
I can talk about either. So, I mean, our services on our webpage talk about, you know, fishing gear evaluations, et cetera. And often those projects are driven by industry that will come to us and say, listen, we're having pressure from the sustainability sector or from our retailers that buy our product and they want us to fish more sustainably. So let's just take an example of saying that that's going to be reducing bycatch. So they come to us and say, we need to reduce bycatch. We are never the ones coming to the fishing industry saying, okay, this is how you should design your gear, because obviously the best experts in the world are the fishing industry themselves. You know, they've fished for a long, long time and they know how the gears work, etc. But our job is to help them compare new gears to old gears, basically, and say, is there a statistical difference? Where do those differences lie? But I think one thing that a lot of people seem to forget is that it's not just about saying, okay, the old gear was really unsustainable because there's lots of bycatch and it catches 10 tons per haul, let's say, and the new gear catches 10 tons per haul. So that means that it's okay and economically it's viable, because there's a lot of economics that have nothing to do with the amount of catch. You know, so for example, if you have a gear that uses a lot more fuel or it's much more expensive, or maybe you need to have a new piece of gear every 3 months, obviously those operational expenses add up over time. So our job is basically to evaluate a much wider picture than just what ends up in the net, as well as the ecological sustainability, make those comparisons and then take them to the industry and say, okay, this is what things look like. And normally, if we're lucky enough, the project doesn't stop there, then it will be a case of taking it to regulators and saying, okay, gear number two, the new gear, does work really well. It is economically viable. The industry is willing to adopt it. Can we try and, you know, shape policy or shape management so that there will be dispensation to use this? And then eventually that gear will come online and be one that, you know, you're not going to get pulled up by a patrol if you use it. So that's the ultimate goal. And we have some projects that are running at the moment doing exactly that. So it's quite exciting, but it's It's a long and arduous process for sure, because it's not quick to do these things.
I'm going to return us to the fish trade policy in a bit, but to
Sure.
get there now, I'd actually like to just mention, right, that you and I didn't chat very much at this workshop. It was a really great workshop in Pittsburgh. It was last spring, I think, at the University of Pittsburgh, co-sponsored by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, as well as the Center for Governance and Markets at the University of Pittsburgh. This was my first time in Pittsburgh, maybe in my life, actually, although my father kind of grew up there. I really had a great time at the workshop. There were several different topics that were brought up, and to get us talking about this, I'd love to just hear what your motivations were for coming there. Because one of the nice things was it was a mix of folks in different kind of career stages and paths. So, what brought you there?
So I was invited, and I remember that my first reaction was, oh, another one of these things, it'll be a load of waffle, etc. But then I heard back from the team at Mercatus, and they sent me the list of attendees, and I kind of looked up everybody's profiles, yours included, and I thought, oh wow, this is certainly a diverse bunch. And also nice for me is the fact that this the I mean, I knew two or three people there, but in general, everybody was kind of a new person that I could meet. So there's obviously like a selfish kind of drive for me to go. It's like, oh, I can expand my own network, etc. But then when I looked at the kind of topic or subject areas that people covered in terms of their expertise, it was a really phenomenal mix of people that were at the workshop. And I also thought it was a good idea. I have to admit, traveling all the way from Edinburgh, Scotland to Pittsburgh for 2 or 3 days seemed to be a bit over the top, and I said, could we do it online? But they convinced me to go, and I had a great time, and I think it was really well worth it. And it was good because everybody understood the aim of the workshop, I think, but everybody came at it from different directions. And it's resulted in all of these nice kind of little thought pieces that have been published on their website now. So yeah, it was well worth going and had a good time.
And so, Andrew, to get us back to trade policy, one of the themes, arguably the main theme that the organizers wanted us to discuss, was this new WTO rule about fish subsidies. Actually, I don't know. Is that exactly about trade? I'm kind of conflating these two a little bit more in my head than they should
Well, I
be.
mean, the fuel subsidies issue can be about trade because you can use trade to kind of control what happens in terms of the subsidization, because if you stop two countries trading, the best way to control a country is to limit its trade, basically,
Okay.
or start a war with them. But I don't think that would happen over fishing. Hopefully not. So yeah, I think they are linked for sure. But yeah, and that's the other thing about the workshop. It's very good timing based on the fact that, we've been slowly, slowly climbing this hill, and we've almost reaching a climax now with the World Trade Organizations, and there's an agreement that's formed and people are signing it. But whether or not that's going to turn into actionable change is a different matter. But I think the Mercatus workshop was really useful in getting thoughts down on paper to try and give it an extra push from, I mean, I would classify that meeting as kind of a think tank, I guess, like a very short, sharp think tank. Yeah.
So, do you have an opinion about fish subsidies and/or trade policies generally, and how they're does this interface now with kind of your current work, or have you developed some opinions about the best direction? It sounds like you're in favor of ending the subsidies.
Oh, careful.
Okay.
No, I think, well, I would say it's amazing if you look at, for example, Rashid Somaila's work, that actually calculates the economics of subsidization, etc. And you'll find that so many fishing operations are just not profitable without that government support. So, if they're not being kind of paid to fish through subsidies on their fuel, they would never be economically profitable. So that to me is quite astounding, and that would therefore point to the fact that, if a fish operation can't operate economically without help, then maybe it shouldn't exist. But my interest is this idea that when there are unfair practices in fisheries, whether it's different kind of fishing agreements between countries or illegal fishing potentially from one country to another, I think that the subsidization piece can be quite interesting because it can be used to potentially, put a bit of pressure on a country to say, listen, you need to perform better, and you need to work harder towards sustainable outcomes, because there's a lot, particularly on the high seas and distant water fishing fleets, which are these fleets that come from one country, travel halfway across the globe to fish waters that are absolutely removed from their own nation, you know.
Yeah. Also, sorry to put words in your mouth, Andrew. We can also
No, don't
cut my
worry.
version of that question earlier.
No, don't worry.
Okay.
That's fine.
So, moving forward, are you kind of interested in business as usual now? You like the kind of path you're on with Marfish Echo and your team? Are you hoping to grow your presence more? Or maybe you're trying to branch out new direction? Kind of what are your goals individually and collectively, say, in the next 5 years?
Yeah, good question. I think for the time being, I am done with academia for sure, just because I like the pace of consulting, and I couldn't handle the bureaucracy of finally, once you reach kind of professorship, you suddenly have to deal with so much bureaucracy that you were kind of protected from as a postdoc, for example. So that's, I like the speed at which I can work now and the speed of change. I think plan in the long run really is to, I don't necessarily want to grow Marfish Eco into one of these huge consulting firms. I'd rather stay small and good, if that makes sense, you know, because I've found even from going from me and one or two other consultants to now we have kind of 15 to 20, even going from the small to that medium size, it's already very difficult to make sure that the quality we were producing before is still retained today. So I think as you get larger, it's difficult to maintain that control over the quality. But really, I'd like to just work on more diverse projects. We have started doing things in the finance sector now as well, thinking about blue bonds and things as well, and financial incentives for sustainability, which is a whole nother conversation and a piece of what we're doing at the moment. But really, I just continue to be produce coherent work for our clients. And ultimately, I would like to think we could probably fund some more PhDs so we can kind of grow this idea of a consulting firm that has academic rigor inside it, if that makes sense. Because I think that's a really, really valuable thing to do.
So I can't help myself, Andrew. I know you tried to cut off this conversation that you started. What is a blue bond?
Okay, a blue bond. So this is some work we're working on with Planet Tracker, and we were funded initially by the Conservation Finance Alliance about 18 months ago. But the idea is basically, can you potentially pay a fishing community or an industry not to fish? But the way you do that is you get a group of investors that say, okay, we'll put $1 million on the table, and we will distribute it to the community over the next 5 to 10 years, but they will not touch that stock. If slash when the stock replenishes itself, they are allowed to fish again, but the returns from that fish, the economic returns, will be paid back to the initial investors. So it's a bond, but basically your fish are what's bringing you your return, so to speak.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, there's more to come. We've done the first piece of work, has been released, but we're now working on the second. So probably in the next 2 months or so, you'll see some work from that.
I guess one follow-up there. In
Sure.
your work here, it feels like words like markets and financialization often become like the basis for kind of intergroup conflict about how to move forward. I feel like they're either often seen as the savior or the villain in the stories about fish and the environment more generally. Have you experienced that? I mean, do you get like pushback when you're like, oh, we're moving into financialization space? And I know for example, I've talked to many people about catch share policy in fisheries who worry about that being a conduit for the financialization of fish resources, where now you can kind of invest, fishing rights become an investment instrument. And that's
Sure.
born a lot of
Yeah.
critique. And so I think some people when they hear about financialization kind of raises their hackles, maybe unfairly, right? I'm curious if there's been any of that discourse that you've had to engage with in moving in this direction.
Not yet in terms of the blue bonds, because it's so new. I mean, so far over the last 18 months, all we've had is pretty much good conversations. Even if we get somebody that will come and kind of tackle our opinion and say, well, this won't work because of XYZ. I mean, we're still at the kind of proofing stage, I would call it, you know, where we're trying to understand in which context it would work. Back to the turf idea, you know, turfs work in some contexts, they absolutely would not in others. And it's the same for blue bonds as well. You know, we believe that they will work in certain contexts if they're designed correctly with community engagement, but they won't in others. When you're talking about things like financialization and all of this, I mean, I'm not even going to pretend to sit here and understand those words in any detail, but I think blue bonds are still in their infancy. Therefore, we're in this kind of like rose-tinted romantic period where everything's exciting and still quite academic. I think long term, we might well suffer from the same as, quota allocation and all these sorts of things where you potentially end up with a system that just trades rights or trades access, and it just becomes like a financial trading system, which often favors the prepared and generally those that come in more wealthy, and doesn't favor those that actually need the help. So yeah, we do need to be careful with it, but so far I have been very lucky and haven't had to contend with such.
Okay. So it's been nice to hear from you explicitly and implicitly, Andrew, during this conversation, kind of this desire to push back on what we often call kind of panacea thinking of there's only one particular approach. You just mentioned again in terms of the turf. And so I'll make this kind of my last main question here
Sure.
is, I mean, so that feels really important to me because there is, because I do believe this principle that there is no one size fits all to a degree. I also understand where panacea thinking comes from, right? It's kind of easy as the academic to kind of sit on the outside and say, oh, these people that I've maybe never even talked to, why are they thinking this way? It's so simplistic. And me with my ivory tower and privilege of time, I can think about much more complicated ways of doing things. I think anytime you're trying to professionalize an organization that's trying whose value proposition is in part offering advice on what we should do about our problems, there's going to be a tendency to narrow the diversity of the products you're offering. So it's like, okay, we're going to specialize in TERFs. We're going to specialize in this other policy approach. You have to, there's, as you become expert in that approach, you're not going to become an expert. There's an opportunity cost. You're not going to become an expert in five other ways of doing things. So I've just wondered this about organizations that, as a part of professionalization is this kind of developing a ton of vision about how things should be done. And I guess the question is, does me asserting that trade-off resonate with you at all, or do you agree with it entirely? And if not, what do you think I'm missing?
Yeah, no, you make a very good point. This idea that, when you start to focus in on one research area or piece of subject matter, you have less opportunity to look at other things. The model that we have at Marfa Chico, to some extent, can avoid that problem because we have a pool of consultants and staff that means that we do have experts in quite disparate things. So for example, we might have a project that's looking at trying to find sustainable sources of seafood for a pet food manufacturer, let's say, for example. And on the surface, you might think, okay, sustainable sourcing, well, basically we just need to understand certification and see whether or not something is sustainable coming to the market and whether it do. But then you also, if you start to dive a little bit deeper, which is what I'm trying to do with Marfa Chico, we dive a little bit more deeply, and then suddenly you realize that actually there's a logistics component to that project as well. And then you find out that there's also a financial component and an economic component based on the markets as well. So as you dive deeper and deeper, you realize that you are going to need to draw from all this range of skills. So although on the surface, you would win your argument by saying, well, you're going to have to focus on certification because that's what that project's about, I would argue that most of our projects draw from four or five different disciplines, and they come together at different levels for sure. So I mean, definitely, I've become more of a business owner and a manager. I mean, I still have my kind of little interests that I'm keen to follow up on in terms of the subject matter. But really, yeah, with a team, the team's excellent. They're diverse, and they've worked all around the world. And we managed to kind of stay away from just becoming the firm that does this one or two separate things, So, which is why we've got quite a diverse portfolio. And come February, you'll see a new website with all of our projects loaded onto it because I've been terribly lazy with our old website.
It's hard to, yeah. I mean, you kind of mentioned you're kind of like a small business owner. And so it's hard to kind of take care of everything at once when it needs doing.
Yeah.
Implicit in your answer, Andrew, is this idea that a part of the way to meet this challenge is in who's in the room and who you're actually hiring. And that's kind of the underlying driver to whether this problem gets addressed or not.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, And I think that's why it's really important to, maintain a good network of connection. Because, for example, recently we had a project, and we kind of covered all the bases, but I don't want to go into too much detail because I think it's still under NDA, but we could have completed it for the client fairly comfortably. But I kind of felt that we needed a little bit more to kind of stick all of the different subject areas together. And we just contacted a few people, and we went through the FAO and found somebody that I'd never met before, never heard of. And this lady came in and absolutely, smoothed all the rough edges out, and it was perfect. So I think the idea is not to get transfixed on this idea that of like, oh, this is what I do, which is kind of quite an academic way of thinking, where you kind of say, I am the expert in this thing. Whereas, and I don't like the fact that people often frown at this idea of jack of all trades, master of none. I mean, I know that phrase is longer if you look it up properly, but I think jack of all trades can be very useful as long as you are, if I'm the jack of all trades, as long as I'm juggling people that can act as those independent experts to come in and put their ideas into the central pot, So, yeah.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can find more episodes as well as entries in our blog on our website, incommonpodcast.org. The Incommon Podcast is the official podcast of the International Association for the Study of the Commons, or IASC.